Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Heather Stark with Three Women, Three Ways, and we are the show that talks to you about safety, what's in the news, domestic violence issues, all sorts of issues that involve women and that women care about and that men care about as well. And with me today is Connie Sue Brown. Connie, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, good morning, Heather. Yes, this is Connie Sue, also known as Pink Lee, and I am a domestic violence survivor and have been working in the field for the last nearly 15 years. Have my bachelor's degree from the Evergreen State College here in Washington State, emphasizing in social justice. So I'm excited to be here this morning. And how about you, Heather? Tell us about you.
Well, I have got a little bit of chops in the area of domestic violence. I actually have a master's degree with a focus on domestic violence, and I am currently working on a dissertation for my PhD in psychology. And I grew interested in domestic violence as an issue about 10 or 11 years ago. So I've been studying it and working with it ever since. I also wrote a book called Why Doesn't She Just Leave? And it's a story about, it's a book with real stories from real women to try to address that question that everybody who doesn't know domestic violence seems to ask. So I have my areas of particular interest, and Connie Sue, you've been doing advocacy for so long, but what we are going to talk about today, I think, impacts both of us and both of our areas of interest, and that is how domestic violence and interpersonal violence is portrayed in the media.
Yeah.
Have you ever read news stories about a domestic violence situation where you kind of went scratching your head after reading the report? If you have, please give us a call. It is 1-646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. We'd like to hear your information and your feelings about all of this. I'll tell you, Pinkley, what really got me interested was this was several years ago, and I was doing news on the radio, and there was a story about an automobile accident. There was a rollover collision on a city street, and as the breaking news was coming in, details became a little bit more available, and it turns out that there was a man chasing a woman in a car. The woman was trying to get away from him. She was driving fast. She hit another car. She flipped her car. He stopped his car, got out, and tried to shoot her while she was dangling in her upside-down car. And the reason that that spurred my interest in media coverage of domestic violence incidents is for at least 2 days they covered it as an auto accident.
Wow.
That's it. It was just an automobile accident. Because everybody who hits another car gets out and tries to shoot the other guy, don't they? I mean, come on, that's common, isn't it? So that just set me off, and I thought, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And so I started to do a little bit more research, and one of the things that really triggered me, and I think, Connie Sue, you have this at hand, is the State Coalition Against Domestic Violence here did a study. And it's available at the WISCDV, Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, website. And Connie Sue, can you just kind of tell us what that study showed?
Well, basically, Heather, this was a study that was, let me go back up to the main page here. It's titled, so that we give credit to where credit is due here, hold on. It's rather a lengthy document. It's 31 pages. But it's basically, it was first written in June of 2002. It was revised in January of 2008. But the emphasis here on this document by the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence is a guide for journalists and other media professionals who are covering incidences of domestic violence. And for the most part, it says that the information is really inaccurately portrayed as domestic violence, and it gives tips for covering.
You said there's inaccuracy.
Yes.
What do you mean by the inaccuracy?
Well, what it says here is people commonly ask, why do victims stay in abusive relationships? Who are the abusers? And who are the victims? So it goes on to say here that there were two studies in Washington State. The University of Washington School of Communications examined all news coverages, and there was also a study done in the Boston College Media Research Action Project where it focused on 88 articles reporting on 12 DV murders from 1996 to 1999. And it goes on to say that domestic violence murders were rarely labeled as domestic violence or placed in a broader context. And it goes on to say that coverage provided an inaccurate view of domestic violence and actually reinforced myths about abusers. So in other words, people thought that someone had to look or be a certain way. So the sources shaped the stories and were often limited or actually poorly chosen. So their information was not included as being related to domestic violence.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed, that I have noticed in news stories, is there's two things. One is the media always tries to find a reason for it. He owed money, or he was under pressure, or he'd lost his job. They always look for something to tag the reason for this. And it's always something other than he's an abuser.
Right,
the other
right.
thing that I always notice in news articles is that they always, well, not always, that's a generalization, but they usually go find a neighbor or a family member to talk about how wonderful that man is.
Right.
Oh,
exactly.
You know, he was such a nice guy. He was so wonderful. And I think that the Whiskative report that talks about it reinforcing stereotypes, that's exactly what it is. We have a stereotype that the only reason an abuser abuses is because he snapped. It was an anger issue. Something set him off. He snapped. And it was just like he couldn't control himself.
Mm-hmm.
I found one headline as I was doing a little searching this morning, Pinkley, and the headline says, "Man kills own baby after being denied sex."
Unbelievable.
Well, I mean, of all the men in the world, I'm sure quite a few of them have been denied sex quite a few times, and I don't think too many of them have killed their children over it.
Over that, right?
Yeah, well, exactly.
It also goes on to say that that the inaccuracies are basically because they want to blame the victim or abuser, excusing their behavior, or blaming the act on cultural or class differences, reinforcing the idea that fatal violence came out of the blue, like what you just said, as they just snapped, as opposed to being the culmination of a history of violence and controlling behavior. So there's not a lot of research done or interviewing or looking at the patterns of violence in the family, things that have happened before. And as I say that, I want to emphasize that there are times when there may not be anything to report because the survivor may not tell anyone.
Yeah.
And it also goes on to say in the cases of homicide suicides in which the abuser killed himself as well, reporters often label the case as a family tragedy.
Yes, Yes.
And we're less likely to frame the case in terms of domestic violence, even when the evidence of prior domestic violence existed.
Yeah.
So even when there was information that was at hand, it's still being labeled as a family tragedy. Now, mind you, it is a tragedy. It is a tragedy for the family and for the loved ones and the family, you know, and friends. But it's not, it's an abuser behavior and a responsibility. It is not the responsibility of the family, but the impact of domestic violence has a huge rippling effect.
Yes. Yes. And I think that another reason that this kind of reporting, although very prevalent, it does disservice to domestic violence is because not only does it look, it excuses the abuser. For another example here, in September, this is from a newspaper article, in September, a man went berserk and stabbed his 5 sons to death before committing suicide. Well, he just went berserk. You know, I mean,
just snapped.
The other thing that they tend to do in news media is to minimize. If they mention that there was any kind of domestic abuse, they just kind of skirt the issue and minimize it. Here's another article. The latest incident adds to the number of incidences in which spouses opt to murder their children after domestic squabbles.
Wow.
Amid concerns on increased use of drugs that spark acts of murder. So, first of all, we're saying that a domestic violence situation that leads to murder is a squabble. Wow. And again, we're blaming the situation. We're giving an easy out. Well, it was drugs.
Well,
it was alcohol.
Here's a good one, Heather. Here's a quote. It's not a good one. It's actually very sad. In the Rhode Island research, it says it also found stories which inaccurately depicted the dynamics and, again, reinforced common myths such as it doesn't happen around here, substance abuse causes violence, or violence was part of a tragic love. Quoting a sister of the abuser who said, well, he loved them so much, the wife and children, that he wanted to take them with him.
Oh, yes, that's love. Nothing says love like murder, right?
Right.
How sad. So we're looking at media that structures stories to give an excuse. They find an excuse. Another headline I found, debt-ridden dad kills son and himself. Mm-hmm. Oh, we've got a reason right there. Debt. Oh, gosh, that's what caused him to do it. So we've got that search for an excuse that we put right up there. He was drunk, he was drug-ridden, he was debt-ridden. We give him an excuse right up front. And then we minimize if we recognize domestic violence at all, we minimize it as a squabble or I've seen several words used, dispute, a domestic dispute.
Or it was a private matter because it was family related. It was
exactly
in the context of the family, so therefore it should be private.
Yeah. Or we blame the victim. Man kills after being denied sex. Well, she denied him sex, no wonder. You know? So we always look for those excuses, we minimize the domestic violence aspect of it, and we tend to, when I say we, the media tends to blame the victim. So those are three things that I see in so many stories, and I know other people have seen this because I've talked with a number of folks about it. So if you have seen this, if you have an example, please give us a call, 646-378-0430. Tell us about some of the experiences that you have seen in media reporting. Now, I pulled another study, Pinkley, that goes beyond the three things that we just talked about beyond the three issues. And this study says that journalists tend to use a different voice. You know how passive and active voice? Passive voice is kind of like that business speak, you know, that it's a removal. I can say, Pinkley, you had an accident. Okay? Or, and that's active voice, that you did it. Okay? Or I can use the passive voice. An accident was had by Pinkley. Well, then that puts the emphasis on the accident, right? Not who did it. So that passive voice, this study found that journalists tend to use passive voice when reporting male violence against women. But when there's a situation of women's violence against men, they use the active voice. So when a man does it, she was killed. When a woman does it, she killed. And I think that that's really significant. Do you see any significance in that, Pinkley?
Yeah, that's a great point. I never thought of it in that context, Heather. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, besides reflecting the attitude of the writer, mm-hmm. The reader gets a different interpretation of the violence, particularly with respect to the victim's role in bringing the crime on. So we use passive, when we use passive voice, a reader sees the crime victim as more responsible than in passive voice sentences. Okay. So she was killed, active voice.
Right.
And I'm floundering on this one a little bit. My mind is blank. I'm coming up with a blank here. But the passive voice tends to put more responsibility on the victim.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, here are some tips for media coverage to help demystify some of the myths and stereotypes. And it suggests stating, avoid calling domestic violence a relationship problem.
Yeah.
Avoid statements that describe an abusive relation as a violent relationship or troubled marriage, which inaccurately actually describes abuse as an issue between the people, not about the responsibility of the abuser saying this is the direct result of someone's behavior. The first thought that comes to mind about that is, a picture just popped into my head about a bank robber going in and robbing a bank. You're certainly not going to say this was a bank issue. This was not a teller issue. This was not the direct result of customers in a bank. That was the direct result of a behavior of that individual who made a decision on their own to go in and rob a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, and that comes back to the voice thing. You know, I mean, if you say he robbed the bank, then who's to blame there? If you say the bank was robbed by a man, I mean, it's the bank that's the central actor there in that sentence.
Yeah.
So
it goes on to say, refrain from using the words like domestic dispute or a quarrel or an argument. Which actually detracts from the violent and criminal nature of the behavior. Do not focus on the victim's behavior or use victim-blaming language.
What is victim-blaming language? Do they give an example of that?
An example, like what we continuously talk about, Heather. For example, don't ask, why did she stay or why didn't she just leave? And understand the barriers on why the relationship that she didn't leave. I mean, number one, when there's a change to the relationship, I mean, how do we know she wasn't trying to leave? I mean, that's when
true.
The escalation occurs. So
well,
really,
and we know that if a victim is killed, it's most likely when she's trying to leave.
Exactly. Exactly. Can you restate that for our listeners?
When someone is killed in a domestic violence situation, it is more likely that they are killed when they are trying to get out of it than when they're just staying with it day to day.
Yeah, Absolutely.
So I actually, if I can step aside here, I ran into a friend or an acquaintance at a office supply store not too long ago, and we were chit-chatting, and she said, listen, I have a question. I know you do stuff with domestic violence. And I said, sure. And she said, I have a friend who's going through domestic violence. And I went, oh, yeah, that happens, you know, I mean, clearly. And she said, but the woman refuses to leave. Mm-hmm. And you can tell she was very disgusted. And I said, well, does she tell you why she doesn't want to leave? And my acquaintance said, oh, she says she thinks he's going to kill her if she leaves. And just tosses that off. Like it's absolutely, you know, ridiculous. So I spent a couple of minutes explaining to her how if she's afraid she's going to be killed when she leaves, listen to her. She knows this person better than you do. And in fact, statistically, she's probably right. If she's going to be injured or die in that situation, chances are she's going to die when she's trying to leave. So
and I ask the question that comes to mind, Heather, and for our listeners, why would that person minimize so much about the killing part? I mean, as if it is still the responsibility of the survivor, the victim, to control that behavior. I mean, she's
yep.
telling you, this is why I'm not leaving.
And yet the friend is just kind of like, oh, poo-poo.
Right, and totally minimize that statement. That is suggesting, I mean, not often will you actually hear that statement. That is probably the highest risk of lethality if someone discloses, I'm not going to do this or I'm afraid to, because he'll kill me.
Yep. Or the kids.
Or the kids.
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
And I have my own personal theory on this. I haven't seen this written up anyplace, so you have to tell me, Pinkley. I think we tend to blame the victim because we want to protect ourselves. If you're in an auto accident and something bad happens, and I can say you were speeding, you weren't paying attention, you were driving drunk, then I know I'm not going to do that, so I don't have to worry about that horrible thing happening to me.
Right, you don't have any responsibility in that.
Exactly. If I say that you as a victim are doing something that's driving him to do this, then I know I won't do that something, so I'm safe. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily a conscious thing on the part of friends and family, but I do think it's a component. I think it's an unconscious component of how we react to the victim. I want to be safe. I don't want this to happen to me. This can't happen to me because, look, she made a bad choice. I didn't make a bad choice, so I'm safe. Or, well, she continually nags at her husband. I don't do that, so I'm safe. I think it's a self-preservation technique. And when I find people who do that, you know, the what did she do, I kind of very gently suggest that. I actually do. I smile and I say, well, I understand that, you know, if you can find something to pin on her and make it her responsibility, then you just don't do that and you're safe. And people usually say, oh, no. Yeah, and it's okay. We all want to feel safe. So
yeah.
I probably have made a lot of people angry about that one, but I hopefully gave them something to think about as well.
Well, one of the ways that I really respond to that is it's instead of asking the question, why doesn't she leave or why this or why that, I will stop someone and say, rather than ask that question, let's ask a different question. Why doesn't the abuse stop?
Or why does he do that?
And it's about survivor safety, and it's about accountability.
Yeah.
It's putting the emphasis back on the person who's creating the harm within the relationship.
Because frankly, I don't care if she's the biggest nag, the biggest, mouthiest, nastiest woman in the world. She's not the one who's hitting herself.
Right.
And there are plenty of us mouthy ladies out there that don't happen to be with an abuser. So, you know, taking that emphasis away from anything that she does or doesn't makes people feel, or putting the emphasis, rather, on something that she does or doesn't makes people feel a lot safer.
Well, Heather, we have one of our other three women, Deborah Adams, who's not with us this morning. She's not feeling well. And so we put good thoughts out there, Deborah. And I have about probably a 2 to 5 minute story, a personal story I would like to share with you, Heather, and our listeners about my own personal experience with the media.
Okay.
Which is very interesting because I actually hadn't even thought about it when we were talking about this topic today, but I realize that it's a really an important piece to the story that I have lived through, and it really emphasizes, I think, the reason for my nickname, Pinkly. So,
okay.
to just tell my story in a short way, but highlighting the message that we're talking about, and that's media. I fled my home with pretty much absolutely nothing in July of 1997 for our listeners. I left in my car feeling absolutely, totally worthless. I was really actually ready to drive myself to a mental institution. I was just at a breaking point thinking that this is me and that I had gone crazy. So after several months of getting to a different place, I found myself in a terrible, terrible divorce, dissolution process. And by leaving, what really happened was that I completely left every ounce of control to him. It enabled his controlling behavior. And when I say that, that means that I had no access to my clothes, I had no access to medication, money, my personal belongings. I did file for a domestic violence protection order and was granted that and left, to have that protection, which I was really grateful for. But it did escalate once that was granted. And in the mix of that, I found myself agreeing to a restraining order within the divorce proceeding, which I was adamantly against. And
you didn't want a restraining order against him?
I didn't want a restraining order against me. It was a mutual.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for that clarification.
I can just interject that that's a common tactic. If a woman gets a restraining order, then the abuser will immediately ask for a restraining order against her.
Yeah,
and
but
it's
this
often.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But this was in the divorce proceeding. So my attorney presented it to me as, oh, yeah, this is very common in divorce proceedings where there's restraining orders, which basically says, you know, you don't take money out of this account or to do this, that, or this, or that. But what it did, Heather, is it prevented me from going back to my home, prevented me from having access to anything. So basically how I interpreted that later on was that it really gave him more control. So I had my domestic violence protection order, but now we now had a mutual restraining order. So to make a long story short, I was allowed after many months and court battles and just some really horrific things that occurred during the divorce proceedings to go back into my home. But I had to go back into my home with a security guard to make sure, and the purpose of the court allowing me to go back into the home was to document what I had left. Because now we were fighting over things.
Mm-hmm.
I was so infuriated that I was allowed to go back into my home and I was ordered to take a videographer, someone who would actually tape the contents of my home, and a security guard. I felt like I was being watched. I felt like I was now the perpetrator. And I was so damn angry that I said to myself, I'm going to protest this. But I'm going to protest it in a way that nobody's going to know except the media.
Oh.
I made several very large pink signs. And as I arrived on this particular day where I had a security guard and someone to actually say, I'm going to come with you to prove everything that was left in the home, I staked these very large pink signs out in front of my yard.
And what do the signs say?
That this was domestic violence. You know, I did leave. There was abuse. This is domestic violence.
Yeah.
And before I left and staked up the home, was going to stake out my home, I called Cairo News, I called King 5 News, and I called Como News. And I called a couple local news paper agencies in our area.
Mm-hmm.
And said, this is what I'm doing. I want you to come and cover this story. Well,
wow.
As I entered the home, pardon me.
I'll let you go. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, of course, I was scared. I was nervous. I was frustrated. I was angry. I felt like I was being completely re-victimized, not only by the legal system, but by the way I had to prove what I had left in the home. Because, of course, his accusation was is that she took everything or that she took what she deserved to have. So I went into the home and started videotaping with his videographer, with the security guard, mind you, standing next to me. And all of a sudden, I get this knock on the door. And someone's saying, there's a news reporter outside your door. So I am now standing in the home that I left. This was about 7 or 8 months later. And there was someone who actually showed up from Cairo News with a camera and was interviewing me. And I couldn't believe it because I'd actually forgotten that I'd even put out these pink signs and called the news media because I was so now involved in the contents of my home and the emotions that took over after not being in my home for so many months, finding, oh my gosh, there's the medication I needed, or wow, you know, there's that shirt I was looking for, or, you know, all of the personal attachments that you have to your things that you've not had access to, you know, some of your basic necessities.
Yeah.
So the person from Cairo News interviewed me, and I said, look, you know, even in a big house like this with double doors, domestic violence happens everywhere because you would never think, oh, my gosh, this home, his position, the lifestyle we had, that domestic violence would actually occur.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So unbeknownst to me, they aired it. And that is sort of the prelude of the pinkness that evolved into my life. Because they had dubbed it the Pink Protest.
Oh, really?
Not this is domestic violence, not that this woman is fighting for her life, but the Pink Protest. And unbeknownst to me, it never, ever occurred to me that they would interview him. So after they left, they called and talked to his attorney.
An attorney. Good, good, good.
So the attorney was just like, oh, she's blowing this all out of proportion. She's not stable. You know, he has nothing to say. There's no comment. This is impacting his public persona, his work. So now, therefore, it was me that was crazy. I mean, who would go and protest their own house? Who would put up pink signs or any signs in front of their house saying, this is not right, that I am now not allowed back into my home?
So how did the media coverage go?
Well, the coverage, they covered my statement, and of course I was, you know, hypervigilant. I was escalated because it was in a very emotional moment for me to go back into the home that I left. And basically they completely minimized it. It was, but now his statement is, well, you know, she's not stable. She's a little bit crazy. He really doesn't have any comment. So, of course, I'm the one on the media looking like the crazy person, right? I'm stumbling over my words. I knew what I wanted to say, but what I really said was already in this, in the posters, in the signs that I staked out in my front yard. This is domestic violence. I did leave. I did.
Yep.
And this is, this was the result of my leaving, that now I'm allowed, quote unquote, to go back into my home.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was so humiliating and so degrading that I had to have a security officer, somebody there to watch me to make sure I didn't take anything that was already mine. It was a total re-victimization. But you know what? I said to myself, you know, I told a couple of really close friends that I was going to do this, and they were like, oh, no, don't do that. You know, oh, that's just going to make him more mad.
Yep.
And I said to myself, to hell with it. I really don't care right now. I want the message to get out there. So I did have my message heard, but it was somewhat minimized by the fact, I mean, I had no idea they would interview him. Why would they do that?
Well, you know, as a journalist, you always have to get both sides, or at least you should.
Right.
You know, so, and quite frankly, as a journalist, when you said that you called the media, I thought, uh-oh. And I thought that for two reasons. One is because very rarely do you get your story told the way you want it to be told.
Right.
When you deal with the media, you have lost control of your message if you do that.
And that was basically what happened.
Secondly,
what happened.
That gives him more ammunition.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, if it were my ex-husband, he would have sued me for defamation of character or something.
Mm-hmm.
He would have found a way to sue me. And, of course, since he had most of the money, since he had all of the money, and
right.
I had very limited resources, as most women do who are leaving the situation, you know, I mean, he can abuse you through the courts by repeatedly creating court actions and suits and legal documents that you or your attorney has to respond to. And as you probably know, I mean, that doesn't take very long to just empty the entire piggy bank, assuming you had a piggy bank to start with.
Well, when I say the re-victimization, the story that I've given for our listeners illustrates that. I mean, it made no common sense to have to, verify that no, what was there in the house was still in the house.
I think that it also illustrates what the media doesn't understand, and quite frankly, courts don't understand, and a lot of people don't,
right.
About domestic violence, and that is a woman who has been victimized, up to 85% of women who have been in domestic violence suffer from PTSD. And you mentioned the hypervigilance. That's an absolute fallout. That's a symptom of PTSD. You also mentioned the, frazzled, you know, frantic
state.
Feeling you have.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a symptom of PTSD. So,
it's a reaction. It's a normal reaction to a very abnormal situation.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget, here you have a woman in the media who seems, and of course, I have not met an abuser yet who doesn't say she's crazy, she's mentally ill. So you have a woman who's hypervigilant. You have a woman who's frazzled, who has limited resources, who's frantic about her children. And how does she come across compared to a man who's totally in control? Because let's not forget that that's what abuse is about. It's about control. Who was it, Evan Stark, that came up with the term coercive control? It's not about drugs. It's not about personalities. It's not about how was the dinner. It's about coercive control. So you have an abuser who is in control. That's what they do. So if you have, before a judge or before media, a man who comes across as totally under control and totally with it and totally together, compared to a woman who's frazzled, he says she's crazy, and she sure acts that way because she's real frazzled, she can't finish a sentence, she's distracted, she's, you know, all of those things that are very typical of women who are being abused. But the media doesn't understand that, and the courts don't understand that. So when they see Mr. In Control compared to Miss Out of Control, they normally tend to give more credibility to the person who's in control.
And that's their whole tactic.
Yep, exactly. So I think what it comes down to is a lack of understanding, a lack of education about the dynamics of domestic violence on the part of media. Now, some media are really, really good at reporting things like that. They kind of get it. They've had training. But unfortunately, not too many do. I actually read a news story this morning. I wish I had clipped it. And it was about some sports figure. It's today's news. And some sports guy, I don't know whether it was a football team or something, but he shot and killed his girlfriend and then committed suicide. And he drove away and then committed suicide. And I read that story, and I thought, there is no victim blaming here. There's no excuses portrayed for why he might do that, that he's under pressure, that he's this, that, and the other thing. It was just straightforward reporting. This is what he did, and this is where it occurred, and this is the, you know, the, where it occurred, and, you know, just the straightforward stuff. And I actually thought, wow, this is good reporting. This is mm-hmm. very good reporting. Unfortunately, we usually see the ones, you know, like some of the samples that I gave you, you know, debt-ridden dad kills son and himself, you know, man kills four children, the latest incident adds to the number of instances in which spouse opt to murder their children after domestic squabbles, man kills own baby after being denied sex, man went berserk and stabbed his five sons to death, you know, there's excuse after excuse after excuse in those headlines, in those stories. And I know that there are places like Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence who are working to educate reporters. But having graduated from a journalism school, I can tell you there's very little coverage of or understanding about domestic violence that's actually being taught to journalists. And, of course, today, we don't really have a lot of trained journalists. We have, you know, at least half of our news, mainstream news, comes from what we call the citizen reporters, you know, people who are there with their cell phones when something happens. And they're either putting it on the web or the major news media is contacting them for input into what happened. So we have a bunch of people who aren't trained, who are professionals, and we have a bunch of people who aren't trained at all, who are generating news from a personal level, you know, from a citizen level, and it all combines to end up with stories about domestic violence where we're blaming the victim, we're using that passive voice, we're using all sorts of ways to minimize and excuse these horrific incidents. That was kind of a monologue, Pinkley. I'm sorry.
Oh, I agree. And so what I'd like to do is just quickly go through some of the tips that the Washington State Coalition is giving for tips on accurately recovering domestic violence. And before I do that, I think that when you were saying that you weren't really trained as a journalist on domestic violence, it makes me very frustrated when I think of the many, many disciplines such as legal, social health, mental health, like counselors. I mean, people that are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis, people that they're working with that are potentially in a domestic violence situation are not trained.
Well, they usually get some, you know, they have it mentioned. They have it mentioned in another class. There's no specific information about this particular thing. I mean, don't forget that one in four women, that's 25% of our female population that is going to experience this. That's pretty darn significant.
Yeah, you would think there would be more extensive training, though, in different disciplines, even with
exactly. I think
faith-based leaders, when you're, you know, people go to their faith-based. I mean, just different disciplines, I think we could do a much better job in educating our society in domestic violence. But let's focus back on the media. It says, place the crime in the context of domestic violence. Acknowledge that domestic violence is not a private matter. Look into prior history of domestic violence and let the story evolve. The next tip is convey that domestic violence is a pattern of behavior, like what we've talked about. It's about being in control, and that often escalates when a victim is trying to leave or has left the relationship. And we've talked a little bit about that today. Illustrate the warning signs of an abusive relationship. Ask, were there any warning signs? Ask coworkers, friends, and family. When interviewing a domestic violence survivor, consider the safety and confidentiality needs of the interviewee. Ask the survivor, is it safe to use their real name? Or if a fictitious name would be more effective in helping keep them safe. What to avoid when covering domestic violence crimes. Avoid calling domestic violence a relationship problem.
I love that one.
Do not, and I think I've already talked about this, do not focus on the victim's behavior or use victim-blaming language. Do not ask, why didn't she just leave? That blames the victim or survivor.
Yep.
Do not assume some cultures or classes are violent and others are not. Focusing on the economic status or ethnicity of the victim or abuser confuses the point that domestic violence, let's emphasize this, crosses all lines of race, class, and culture. And I can say for myself, I think that was probably one of the hardest things to get across in my situation was that, yes, this person was very powerful financially, but he was equally as using that power in a destructive way in the marriage.
Yeah.
So again, that class and culture. Avoid using sources emotionally connected to the abuser or sources that do not have any significant information about the crime or those involved. Avoid treating domestic violence crime as an inexplicable tragedy beyond the reach of community action. And those are some of the tips that we can provide. And I just don't think for media, but for anyone who is faced with that situation of supporting someone who they think might be in a domestic violence situation.
I think you're right. I think that that's a wonderful article. And again, if somebody out there would like to access that article, you can go to the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and it's available on their website.
And I also want to point out for our listeners, if you think that you're experiencing domestic violence or wish to speak to someone, you can call in. This is the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. And they can connect you with a local program where you can talk to an advocate and get support. Heather, I don't know if you heard about this, but I thought this was an amazing, newsworthy, it's really interesting. It was a TV anchor person in Honolulu in early part of November, who actually, his name is Jay Cunningham, an anchor on KHON in Honolulu, had reported that a friend of his was killed Monday, was killed in alleged act of domestic violence. And we use the word alleged because we can't prove it from this point, but that's a safe and protective name to use legally. And he made an emotional pledge on the air that over the next year, quote unquote, whenever a woman or child was killed in domestic violence incident, he would shave his head, starting with his friend's death. He said that he, his mother, and brother had all been victims of domestic violence, and he was very emotional on the air, and no one knew that he was going to do this, except for the person that was shaving his head. And he became very emotional, and you often don't see reporters or news anchor people becoming emotional, but this gentleman actually shaved his head on live on TV in support of his friend who was killed because of domestic violence.
I think that's stunning. You know, sometimes when we talk about domestic violence, and because it's so prevalent that it's man-on-woman violence, we do tend to use the word she for the victim and he for the perpetrator. Sometimes we forget how many men there are out there who are working really hard to try and deal with the issue of domestic violence and trying to educate other people about it and trying to be supportive. That's impressive. You know, one of the other things that I wanted to do, because we've talked about several books here, and I wanted to real quickly give some more references for people who want to know more about domestic violence. And one of the books that really helped me is The Verbally Abusive Relationship by Patricia Evans. Again, that's The Verbally Abusive Relationship by Patricia Evans. And I was looking for the other one here. It's a book called Not to People Like Us. And I don't have the author in front of me, but basically what that is a book about domestic violence in the upper economic echelon. And I think a lot of times people do not understand that domestic violence isn't picky about what your checkbook balance is, that domestic violence does happen, and it happens a lot with people of means. And it's important, I think, for people, if even other victims, to understand that, yeah, this does happen, and just because somebody might have money doesn't mean she has money. He usually controls that funding. So if she takes off like you did, Deborah, and she has to go and leave everything at home, she has no more resources than anybody else, even though her husband has tremendous resources.
What I said, going back to the question, why didn't she just leave? Well, I did leave. I was doing what I thought I was supposed to do. That was the message that I'd always heard, and that go to a domestic violence shelter. And honestly, Heather, I appreciate you bringing up the book about the verbally abusive relationship, because that was one of the starting points of my understanding what I was experiencing, because the physical aspect was, well, it got to the point where really I wished he would just hit me and get it over with, because then I could say, wow, this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. It never really occurred to me to say that I'm in a domestic violence situation. So I think that the culmination of, A, I did leave, B, I didn't have resources, and C, realizing, oh, wow, this is a domestic violence situation, it was really an important piece for me to want to tell my story. And at that time, I thought the media was going to be the perfect outlet for that.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, a lot of people think that the courts are going to be perfect for handling that.
Absolutely.
And we know that that's not it. You know, courts aren't necessarily about justice. They're about laws. And sometimes the laws and the way that they're portrayed are not benefiting the domestic violence victim. So, you know, it's the same thing with the media. Sometimes it does not benefit the and plus there's always the risk, like I said. you know, my husband would have sued me silly if I had done something like that. So I had kind of hunkered down and tried to not do anything further to antagonize him. The other thing I wanted people to know is that there are different types of domestic violence. We've talked about that before, and that there are different types of abusers, and perhaps we'll cover that in a future show. But not every abuser is violent. Not every abuser is physical, but it is about that control, that coercive control. And if you're dealing with a controller, actually, Evan Stark, in his research, he discovered that lethality is higher among abusers who are controlling, even if they've never used physical violence. So it's their dedication to that controlling that is really significant, and a lot of times they don't have to raise a fist to do that or break a bone.
Right.
You know, it's
well, one of the things, Heather, that did start evolving during that period of time was, for me, I was doing a lot of journaling, and I know that our other diva, Deborah Adams, who's not with us today, usually ends our show in a quote, and I would like to share with our listeners something that I, during that time, that very, very tumultuous time, again, just coming to the realization that, oh, I was in this horrible domestic violence situation, I wrote something down which I'd like to share.
Okay.
And I say to myself and for our listeners, out of things we cannot think of being comprehensible, we can come to a still place and comprehend.
Oh, very nice. Well, you know, I prepared a little something too to try and make up for Deborah not being here.
Great.
And, I actually would like to read a poem that I wrote.
Absolutely, go.
And this is in my book, Why Doesn't She Just Leave? And this poem is called Make Him. The bruises inside my head are dark, purple, throbbing. The words are blows, one after another. My voice is too loud, too harsh. I am too argumentative. He cannot talk to me. I don't listen, he says. He says it all. When he is away, the children and I break eggs in the sink, use egg beaters to make them foamy, add food coloring to see what happens. They wear little aprons I made as they stand on their chairs at the sink. We make play clay and use cookie cutters, gather leaves and iron them between sheets of waxed paper. When it is almost time for him to come home, the children get quieter. We clean up the mess, get ready for bed. I can protect them. If he looks angry, I push the children behind me and back up toward the stairs. I have nowhere to take them. If you leave me, you'll be sorry, he says. I'm sorry, I can't leave you, I think. If you'd just do things my way, the right way, it would be fine, he says. But it's never fine. The bruises in my head grow larger. One day my son looks at me and says, I wish you would make him go away. I will try, my baby.
Wow.
So,
well, thank you, listeners. That's it. We are three women.
Three ways. Three divas.
Three divas. And tune in next week, Saturday at 10 a.m. for another show from the Three Women, Three Ways, Three Divas. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week at 10 a.m. Pacific time.